Our pastor says a large family is a blessing and we mustn't refuse gifts from God. On any other day, in any other mood, Garrett might have tried to coax her into viewing the issue from a different perspective. Instead, she found herself saying curtly, "I suggest you tell your pastor that it's none of his business how many children you have, unless he offers to help pay for them. One rather doubts the good Lord wishes for you and your entire family to end up in the poorhouse." Surprised and offended, Mrs. Notley stood from her chair, still clutching the tear-dampened handkerchief. "I should have expected blasphemy from a female doctor," she snapped, and stormed out of the consultation room. Garrett lowered her forehead to her desk, stewing in frustration and guilt. "Suffering saviour," she muttered. Before 5 minutes had passed, Dr. Havelock came to stand at the doorway. Before he even spoke, Garrett saw from his expression that he'd heard about what had happened.
"I shouldn't have to remind you that our patients are not mechanical creatures," he said, matter-of-factly. "They come to us with physical and spiritual concerns. You have an obligation to treat their opinions and feelings with courtesy."
"Why is Mrs. Notley's pastor dispensing medical advice?" Garrett asked defensively. "He should stick to his line of work and leave me to mine. I don't go to his church to deliver sermons, do I?"
"A fact for which his congregation is profoundly grateful," Havelock assured her.
Garrett dropped her gaze and rubbed her face wearily. "My own mother died in childbirth because she didn't receive adequate medical attention. I would like my female patients to know how to protect and care for themselves. At the very least, they should understand how their own reproductive systems work." Havelock's gravelly voice softened.
"As you're well aware, girls are taught from early childhood that any interest in the workings of their own bodies is shameful. A young woman is praised and admired for her ignorance of sexual matters until her wedding night, when she's finally introduced to intimacy with pain and confusion. Some of my female patients are so reluctant to discuss their own anatomy that they have to point to an area on a doll to tell me where it hurts. I can scarcely imagine how difficult it must be for a woman to take responsibility for her physical health when she's always been told she hasn't the moral or legal right to do so. What I do know is that it is neither up to you nor me to judge her. When you speak to a patient like Mrs. Notley, keep in mind that women receive more than enough condescension and arrogance from male doctors. They don't need it from you as well."
Humbled and contrite, Garrett mumbled, "I'll write her a letter of apology."
"That would be appropriate."
There was a long pause.
"You've been ill-tempered all week. Whatever your personal problems are, they have no place at work. Go on holiday if necessary."
Go on holiday? Where in heaven's name did he think she would go? What was there for her to do? Havelock regarded her dually.
"In light of your current disposition, I hesitate to mention it, but I would like you to accompany me to a soiree at the Home Secretary's private residence at the behest of a colleague I've known for many years, Dr. George Salter."
"No, thank you." Garrett lowered her forehead to the desk again.
"Dr. George Salter," Havelock repeated. "The name has no significance, do you?"
"Not really," came her muffled voice.
"He was recently appointed as the chief medical officer of the Privy Council. Having learned of the report you're writing on workhouse conditions, Salter asked me to bring you to the soiree."
"I would rather set myself on fire."
"Good God, woman! Salter is an advisor to the Queen. He helps to shape public health legislation and administration for the entire British Empire. He would like to include a female perspective on these issues, especially as they pertain to women and children. There's no woman more qualified than you to provide him with informed opinions and recommendations. It's the opportunity of a lifetime."
Garrett knew she should be excited, but the thought of dressing up to attend a formal event and mingle with a crowd of political people filled her with gloom. She raised her head to look at him dully. "I'd rather not meet him on some frivolous occasion. Why can't I visit his office instead? One can't exactly project an air of gravitas while prancing through a polka." Havelock's bushy white eyebrows rushed downward.
"You have more than enough gravitas. Try for charm instead."
One of the reasons I entered the medical profession is so I would never have to be charming.
A goal you've achieved with great success, Havelock informed her sourly. However, I insist that you come with me to the soiree and try to be amiable.
Is Mrs. Havelock coming with us?
No. She's away visiting her sister in Norwich.
He pulled a handkerchief from his pocket and extended it to her. I don't need that, Garrett said irritably.
Yes, you do.
I'm not weeping.
No, but you have pencil shavings on your forehead.
Although Havelock's face was expressionless, he couldn't quite keep the hint of satisfaction from his tone. Chapter 10 No fairy godmother could have been more efficient than Lady Helen Winterbourne, who had thrown herself enthusiastically into the project of making Garrett ready for the soiree. She had enlisted the store's chief dressmaker, Mrs. Allenby, to alter a new dress she hadn't yet worn, and refused to allow Garrett to pay for it. "You've done so much for me and my family," Helen had insisted. "Don't deprive me of the enjoyment of doing something for you in return. I intend to outfit you in a dress that does you justice." Now, on the evening of the event, Garrett sat at the vanity in Helen's spacious dressing room. Helen had asked her own lady's maid to arrange Garrett's hair. And like many ladies' maids who affected Gallic names and accents to please their employers, Pauline was actually French. She was an attractive woman of middling height, broomstick-thin, with the keen, world-weary eyes of someone who had, at an earlier time in her life, endured hard experience. As Garrett conversed with her in French, Pauline relayed that as a girl she had been a Parisian seamstress and had nearly starved to death while working 18-hour days sewing slop shirts. A small bequest from a deceased cousin had enabled her to move to London and find work as a housemaid, and eventually become trained for the position of lady's maid. To Pauline, the preparations for an evening out were a serious undertaking. After scrutinising Garrett thoroughly, she picked up a pair of tweezers, used two fingers to stretch the skin of Garrett's brow, and began to pluck. Garrett flinched at each little sting of uprooted hair. "Is this necessary?" "Oui," Pauline continued to pluck. "Aren't they thin enough already?"
"They're caterpillars,"
Pauline replied, wielding the tweezers mercilessly. Helen intervened in a soothing tone.
"Pauline is only removing a few stray hairs, Garrett. She does the same for me."
Regarding Helen's sleek, fine brows, the tips ending in precise points, Garrett subsided uneasily. When the unruly brows had been deemed sufficiently tamed, Pauline used a soft bristled brush to dust a fine veil of pearl powder over her face, giving it a satiny, even finish. Garrett frowned as she watched Pauline set a pair of curling tongs over a spirit lamp in a wrought-iron base.
"What are you planning to do with those? I can't wear my hair in curls. I'm a doctor."
Ignoring her, Pauline divided her hair into pinned-up sections, brushed out a long lock, and folded a curling paper around it. A waft of steam rose as she skillfully wrapped the hair around the tongs. Garrett held deathly still, fearing any sudden movement might result in scorch marks on her forehead. After approximately 10 seconds, Pauline slid out the tongs and removed the paper. Garrett blanched as she beheld the long corkscrew-shaped curl.
"Dear God! You're going to make me look like Marie Antoinette?"
"I think I'll ring for some wine," Helen said brightly, and hurried to the bell pull.
Pauline proceeded to turn every lock of hair on Garrett's head into a bouncy spiral, while Helen distracted her with conversation. As the clock struck 8, Helen's little half-sister Caris came into the room. The 6-year-old was dressed in a ruffled white nightgown, her fine blonde hair twirled around strips of calico that had been tied into little bundles on her head. Reaching out with careful fingers to touch one of the long curls, Caris asked,
"Are you going to a ball?"
"A soiree, actually."
"What is that?"
"A formal evening with music and refreshments." Caris moved to sit on her older sister's knee.
"Helen," she asked earnestly, "do Prince Charmingses go to soirees?"
Sliding her arms around the child, Helen cuddled her close.
"Sometimes they do, darling. Why do you ask?"
"Because Dr. Gibson hasn't caught a husband yet."
Garrett laughed. Caris, I would rather catch a cold than a husband. I have no wish to marry anyone. Caris gave her a wise glance.
You will when you're older.
Helen buried a smile amid the little rag curl bundles on the child's head. Pauline turned Garrett's chair to face away from the vanity mirror and began to pin her hair up, section by section. She used a fine-toothed comb to tease and texture the roots of each curl before twisting and pinning it into place.
C'est fini,
she finally pronounced, and handed Garrett a hand mirror so she could view both the front and back. To Garrett's pleased surprise, the coiffure was lovely. The front had been left in gentle waves, with a few loose tendrils at the hairline. The rest had been formed into a soft coronet of loops and curls at the top of her head, leaving her neck and ears exposed. As a finishing touch, Pauline had inserted a few hairpins tipped with clear glass beads that glittered among the upswept locks.
"Not Marie Antoinette?" Pauline asked, looking smug.
"No, indeed," Garrett said with an abashed grin. "Merci, Pauline. You've done a magnificent job. Tu es artiste." With great care, the lady's maid helped Garrett into an elegant dress of pale blue-green silk, with a transparent, shimmering overlay. The gown needed little ornamentation other than a fraise trim, a thin froth of ruffle at the neckline. The skirts were drawn back to reveal the shape of her waist and hips, with the excess folds and draperies flowing gracefully to the floor. It concerned Garrett that the bodice was cut so low, although both Helen and Pauline assured her that it was by no means improper. The sleeves were little more than gauzy puffs, through which her shoulders and arms could easily be seen. Carefully lifting the hem of the skirts, she stepped into heeled evening slippers covered in blue silk and sewn with glittering crystal beads. Garrett went to the full-length looking-glass, and her eyes widened as she beheld this new version of herself. How odd it felt to be dressed in something light, glimmering and luxurious, the skin of her throat and chest and arms exposed. Was she making a mistake going out like this?
"Do I look foolish?" she asked uncertainly. "Is this unseemly?"
"My goodness, no," Helen said earnestly. "I've never seen you look so beautiful. You're prose that's turned into poetry. Why would you worry about appearing foolish?"
"When I'm dressed like this, people will say I don't look like a doctor." Garrett paused, before continuing wryly. "On the other hand, they already say that, even when I'm wearing a surgeon's cap and gown."
Caris, who was playing with the leftover glass beads on the vanity table, volunteered innocently,
"You've always looked like a doctor to me."
Helen smiled at her little sister.
"Did you know, Caris, that Dr. Gibson is the only lady doctor in England?"
Caris shook her head, regarding Garrett with round-eyed interest.
"Why aren't there others?"
Garrett smiled. "Many people believe women aren't suited to work in the medical profession."
"But women can be nurses,"
Caris said with a child's clear-eyed logic.
"Why can't they be doctors?"
"There are many female doctors, as a matter of fact, in countries such as America and France. Unfortunately, women aren't allowed to earn a medical degree here, yet."
"But that's not fair."
Garrett smiled down into the girl's upturned face. "There will always be people who say your dreams are impossible, but they can't stop you unless you agree with them." After arriving at the Winterbourne residence, Dr. Havelock looked her over with approval, pronounced her quite presentable, and collected her in his private carriage. Their destination was the Home Secretary's private residence on Grafton Street, at the northern end of Albemarle. Many of the neighbourhood's grand homes were inhabited by government officials, who insisted it was essential for them to live as men of high social position at taxpayers' expense. "The drawing-room work," it was claimed, "is but a part of the office work," and therefore lavish social entertainments such as this were ultimately for the public benefit. Perhaps that was true, Garrett thought, but it had all the appearance of indulging in the sweets of high office. They were welcomed into the opulently decorated house, its rooms filled with fine art and massive swags of flowers, the walls covered in silk or hand-painted paper. it immediately became apparent that at least 400 guests had been invited to an event that could only have comfortably accommodated half that number. The crush of bodies made the atmosphere stifling and hot, causing ladies to perspire in their silks and satins, and gentlemen to stew in their black evening coats. Servants moved through the gauntlet of shoulders and elbows, with trays of iced champagne and chilled sherbet. The Home Secretary's wife, Lady Tatham, insisted on taking Garrett under her wing. The silver-haired, heavily bejewelled woman steered her expertly through the crowd, introducing her to a large number of guests in rapid succession. Eventually they reached a group of a half-dozen dignified older gentlemen, all looking serious and vaguely perturbed, as if they were standing around a well into which someone had just tumbled. "Dr. Salter," Lady Tatham exclaimed, and a grey-whiskered gentleman turned toward them. He was a short man of sturdy build, his face kind and jowly beneath a neatly trimmed beard. "This fetching creature," Lady Tatham told him, "is Dr. Garrett Gibson." Salter hesitated, as if uncertain how to greet Garrett, then seemed to come to a decision. Reaching out, he shook her hand firmly in a man-to-man fashion, a gesture of equals. Garrett adored him instantly. "One of Lister's protégés, eh?" Salter remarked, his eyes twinkling from behind a pair of octagonal spectacles. "I read an account in The Lancet about the surgery you performed last month. A double ligature of the subclavian artery. The first time it's been done successfully. Your skill is to be commended, Doctor."
"I was fortunate in being able to use the new ligatures Sir Joseph is developing," Garrett replied modestly. "It allowed us to minimize the risk of sepsis and hemorrhage."
"I've read about this material," Salter said. "Made of catgut, is it?"
"Yes, sir."
"How is it to work with?"
As they continued to discuss the latest surgical advancements, Garrett felt very comfortable in Dr. Salter's presence. He was affable and open-minded, not at all the kind of man who would treat her with condescension. In fact, he reminded her more than a little of her old mentor, Sir Joseph. Now she was sorry for having been so grumpy when Dr. Havelock had insisted she attend the soiree. She would have to admit to him that he'd been right and she'd been wrong.
"If I may," Salter eventually said, "I would like to prevail on you from time to time to have your opinions concerning matters of public health."
"I would be delighted to help in any way I can," Garrett assured him.
"Excellent."
Lady Tatham broke in then, laying a glittering, gem-weighted hand on Garrett's arm.
"I am afraid I must steal Dr. Gibson away, Dr. Salter. She is much in demand, and guests are clamouring to make their acquaintance."
"I can't blame them a bit," Salter said gallantly, and bowed to Garrett. "I look forward to our next meeting at my office in Whitehall, Doctor."
Reluctantly, Garrett allowed herself to be drawn away by Lady Tatham. She would have longed to prolong the conversation with Dr. Salter, and was annoyed by Lady Tatham's insistence on pulling her away. One might have assumed from the woman's claim about clamouring guests that people had been forming a queue to meet her, which was certainly not the case. Lady Tatham guided her purposefully toward a looming gold-framed pier glass filling the wall space between two windows.
"There is a gentleman you simply must meet," she said brightly, "a close associate and personal friend of my husband's. It would be impossible to overstate his importance in matters of national security, and he is a frightfully clever man. My poor brain can scarcely follow him."
They approached a fair-haired man standing at the pier glass. His form was thin and elongated, as if he were a figure from a work of French medieval art. There was something striking about him, something repugnant and yet compelling, although Garrett couldn't identify what it was. She only knew that something twisted sickly inside her as she met his gaze. His eyes, unblinking and copper-coloured like an adder's, were set deeply in the narrow framework of his face.
"Sir Jasper Jenkin," Lady Tatham said, "this is Dr. Gibson."
Jenkin bowed, his gaze taking in every subtle variation of her expression. Garrett was grateful to feel a sense of cold, steady purpose descend over her, as it always did just before a particularly difficult surgical procedure or in an emergency. But underneath the surface, her thoughts raced. This was the man who posed such danger to Ethan Ransom, the one Ethan thought might have him killed. Why had Lady Tatton made a point of introducing them? Had Jenkins somehow found out that Garrett was acquainted with Ethan? And if so, what did he want with her?
"Sir Jasper is one of the men in my husband's inner sanctum," Lady Tatton said lightly. "I confess I'm never quite certain how to describe his occupation, other than to say he is Lord Tatton's officially unofficial adviser."
Jenkins chuckled briefly. He didn't smile naturally. The muscles of his face seemed poorly designed for it.
"That description is as accurate as any other, my lady."
How about treasonous bastard, Garrett thought. But she kept her expression perfectly bland as she said demurely,
"A pleasure, sir."
"I've been eager to make your acquaintance, Dr. Gibson. What an exceptional creature you are. The only woman admitted to the honours of this soiree on her own merit, rather than as some gentleman's accessory."
"Accessory?" Garrett repeated, her brows lifting. "I hardly think the ladies present deserve to be described that way."
"It is the role most women choose for themselves."
"Only for lack of opportunity." Lady Tatton giggled nervously and tapped Jenkins' arm lightly with her fan in girlish rebuke.
"Sir Jasper likes to tease," she told Garrett.
Jenkins made Garrett's skin crawl. There was a quality about him, a malignant vitality, that people would interpret as magnetism instead of corruption.
"Perhaps you're in need of an accessory, Dr. Gibson," he said. "Shall we find some virile young trophy for you to flaunt on your arm?"
"I already have an escort."
"Yes, the estimable Dr. Havelock. I see him over there at the side of the room. Would you like me to take you to him?"
Garrett hesitated. She didn't want to spend another second in Jenkins' company, but neither did she want to take his arm. Unfortunately, according to etiquette, a woman was not allowed to walk across the room unescorted at a formal event.
"I would be obliged," she said reluctantly.
Jenkins looked over her shoulder.
"Ah, but wait. We're being approached by an acquaintance of mine, who appears most intent on meeting you. Allow me to make an introduction."
"I would rather not." Lady Tatton leaned to whisper close to Garrett's ear, making her shiver irritably.
"Oh, but you must meet this young man, my dear. He may lack family connections, but he is an unattached gentleman of means, a speculative builder from Durham, and he's exceptionally fine-looking, a blue-eyed stunner, as one of my friends put it."
A strange feeling came over Garrett. Her gaze lifted to the massive pier-glass, which was filled with a blur of colour dabs, like a painting by Monet. She glimpsed herself in the vast mosaic of reflections, the shimmering blue-green dress, her pale face beneath upswept hair. A dark form was moving through the crowd toward her with a controlled and lethal grace she'd seen before in only one man. Alarmed by the violent pulse that had begun to lash in her wrists and throat, Garrett closed her eyes briefly. Somehow she knew who the blue-eyed stunner would turn out to be. She was sure of it, and while her brain warned that something was very wrong, her senses were running wild with anticipation. She could feel a tide of colour rising to the surface of her skin, a bloom of exhilaration and desire. There was nothing she could do to suppress it. The room was an oven. She was being braised alive. To make matters worse, her corset had been cinched a half inch tighter than usual to accommodate Helen's slender measurements, and while it hadn't been a problem up until now, she suddenly couldn't take in enough air. Someone came up behind her, a large form pausing amid the crush of bodies, until there was sufficient room to move to her side. All her skin changed, goose flesh rising despite the sweltering heat. Garrett was filled with ice and fire, nearly ill with excitement, as she turned to confront an unfamiliar version of Ethan Ransom, all steely masculine perfection in formal black and white, every inch of him polished and impeccably groomed.
"What are you doing here?" he asked quietly,
in the English accent that seemed jarring now that she was familiar with his real one. Confused and uncertain, they were supposed to be strangers, weren't they? Garrett asked faintly, "Have we met?" Something in his stone-cold face softened. Sir Jasper knows we're acquainted. He assigned me to help with the security arrangements for tonight, but neglected to mention that you would be here, and for some reason your name was left off the guest list. He levelled a hard glance at Jenkin. I asked Lord and Lady Tatham to make certain Dr. Gibson would attend, Jenkin explained in a silken tone. I thought it would enliven the evening, particularly for you, Ransom. I do so like to see young people enjoying themselves. Ethan's jaw set. Apparently it slipped your mind that I have a job to do. Jenkin smiled. I felt quite certain of your ability to do more than one thing at a time. He glanced from Ethan's hard face to Garrett's flushed one. Perhaps you might take Dr. Gibson to the refreshment room for champagne. She seems rather overcome by my little surprise. Ethan held the older man's gaze for a long moment, while tension laced through the air like metallic thread. Garrett inched closer to him uneasily, realizing he was fighting for self-control. Lady Tatham's fatuous smile began to dissolve. Even Jenkin seemed subtly relieved when Ethan turned to Garrett. She took his arm, her fingertips curling into the sleek, expensive fabric of his dress coat. "A delight to have made your acquaintance, Dr. Gibson," she heard Jenkin say. "As I expected, you are a woman of sharp wit." After a sliver of a pause, he added, "and even sharper tongue." Had Garrett not been so dumbfounded at finding herself in Ethan Ransom's presence, she might have thought of some withering retort. Instead, she responded with a distracted nod and allowed Ethan to lead her away. There was little opportunity to speak as they moved through a crowd as tightly packed as olives in a jar. Not that it mattered. Garrett doubted she could have managed to put more than 3 or 4 sensible words together. She couldn't believe she was with him. Her gaze went to the neat shape of his ear. She wanted to kiss it. She wanted to press her mouth to the place where his close-shaven beard started, and move down to his throat, where she could feel him breathing. But he seemed so unyielding, so unreachable in his iced-over wrath, that she wasn't at all certain he would reciprocate. Silently, Ethan led her through the circuit of rooms and out to a stairwell landing, with a cluster of potted palms near one corner. The palms had been arranged to partially conceal a small, plain door that must have led to the service area of the house. With effort, Garrett managed to speak. "Is that the man you referred to as your mentor? Why did he want me to be here tonight?"
"It's a warning for me," Ethan said flatly, not looking at her.
"A warning about what?"
The question seemed to fracture Ethan's self-assured facade.
"He knows that where you're concerned, I have a preference."
Guiding her past the palms, he opened the service door and took her to the landing of a servant's stairwell. The abrupt cessation of noise was an unspeakable relief. It was cool and dimly lit in the stairwell, the dank staleness relieved by a slight breeze filtering in through outside air vents.
"Preference?" Garrett repeated cautiously. "What does that mean? You prefer me to what?"
As they stopped in a corner, Ethan's head and broad shoulders were silhouetted in the faint glow of a sconce on the opposite wall. She began to tremble as he stood over her, big and dark, his nearness awaking a pulse of high music in her.
"I prefer you to everything," he said gruffly,
and bent to take her mouth with his. Chapter 11. As Ethan kissed her roughly, Garrett melted against him, a moan catching in her throat. Too much pleasure, too much feeling, and yet she wanted more. She couldn't seem to draw it in fast enough. His body was solid and heavy, raw power wrapped in civilized formal attire. Her hand slid inside his black evening coat, following the lean contours of his waist, up to the muscled vault of his ribs and chest. Ethan tensed and shivered at her touch, and angled his head to fit their mouths more tightly together. Still not enough. She had to feel more of him, all of him. Daring to reach down to his hips, she pulled him closer, and gasped,
at the feel of his aroused form against hers. Ethan broke the kiss with a muted growl, the heat of his breath collecting in her ear as he bit gently at her earlobe. Embers caught low inside her and spread heat to every tender place in her body. She was light-headed, weak, every heartbeat riding on a hard, coursing breath. Ethan's head lifted abruptly. One of his fingers came to rest gently against her lips. Garrett was silent, trying to hear over the roar in her ears. Footsteps and echoes of footsteps rose from the depths of the stairwell. She heard the rattle of glass and porcelain, the grunts of effort as a servant carried a heavy laden tray up from the kitchen. Garrett's heart clattered to a halt as she realized she was about to be caught in a scandalous embrace in a servant's stairwell. But Ethan nudged her farther into the corner and blocked her with his much larger form. She leaned into the concealment of his chest, her fingers clamping on the edges of his coat lapel. The footsteps came nearer, then halted.
"Don't mind us," Ethan said over his shoulder, sounding relaxed. "We won't tarry long."
"Yes, sir."
The footman walked past them. Ethan waited until the servant had left the stairwell before he murmured against Garrett's hair, his breath stirring the pinned-up curls.
"You're more beautiful every time I see you. You shouldn't be here."
"I didn't."
"I know. It's Jenkins's doing."
She tilted her head back to look up at him, her face tense with worry, not for herself, but for him. "How did he find out we were acquainted?"
"One of his men followed me and saw us at the night market. From now on, Jenkin will try to use you to manipulate me. He fancies himself a chess master and all of the rest of us pawns. He knows I'd do anything to protect you."
Garrett blinked at that. "Should we pretend to have a falling out?"
Ethan shook his head. "He'd see through that."
"Then what's to be done?"
"He could start by leaving the soiree. Tell Lady Tatham you have the vapors and I'll find a carriage for you."
Garrett stepped back from him and gave him an indignant glance. "The vapors is a term for a hysterical fit. Do you know what it would do to my career if people thought I might succumb to vapors in the middle of a medical procedure? Besides, now that Sir Jasper knows about our mutual attachment, I wouldn't be any safer at home than I am here." Ethan looked at her alertly.
"Mutual?
Why else would I be lurking with you in a servant's stairwell?" she asked dryly. "Of course it's mutual, although I haven't your pretty way of putting things." She would have continued, but his mouth had fastened on hers. His fingers cradled her jaw and cheek as he drew up pleasure from some depthless well inside her. Blindly she clung to his neck and lifted on her toes to make the kiss deeper, stronger. His chest expanded with a violent breath or two, and then he fumbled to clasp her arms and hold her back.
"You have to leave, Garrett," he said unsteadily.
She tried to gather her wits. "Why can't I stay?"
"I have something important to do."
"What is it?" Unaccustomed to taking anyone into his confidence, Ethan hesitated before replying.
"I have to obtain something without being noticed by anyone."
"Including Jenkin?"
"Especially him."
"I'll help you," Garrett said readily.
"I don't need your help. I need you to be far away from here."
"I can't leave. It would look odd. And I have my own reputation to consider. Besides, my presence provides an excuse to slip away and steal whatever it is you're after. Take me with you, and Sir Jasper will assume we've gone somewhere to, well, to do what we're doing now." Ethan's face might have been carved from granite, but his touch was gentle as he stroked her cheek with the backs of his knuckles.
"Have you ever heard the expression, catching a wolf by the ears?"
"No."
"It means you're in trouble, whether you hold on or let go."
Garrett nuzzled her cheek against his hand. "If you're the wolf, then I'll hold on." Recognizing the impossibility of sending her away, Ethan uttered a quiet curse and pulled her so close that her heels were suspended from the floor. His mouth found her neck and did something between a kiss and a bite, very gentle, but with the edges of his teeth. The flat of his tongue stroked her, and she gasped at the corresponding throb down between her thighs.
"Tonight, I'm Edward Randolph," she heard him say quietly. A builder. From Thurham. It took Garrett a moment to understand. Gamely she entered into the pretense.
Why have you come all the way from Durham, Mr. Randolph?
To persuade a few members of Parliament to vote against the bill on building regulations. And while I'm in town, I'm taking in the sights of London.
What do you most want to see? The Tower? The British Museum?
His head lifted.
I'm looking at it, he said,
his gaze holding hers for a few searing seconds before he took her into the refreshments room.
Chapter 12. Relentless noises slurried the air. Conversation, laughter, the creaking of the floor underfoot, the clinks of silver, porcelain and glass, the rattling of trays, the snapping of fans. Guests surrounded the long tables, in the effort to obtain lemonade or ices. As a footman entered the room bearing a tray of desserts, Ethan reached out to snatch one before the servants reached his destination. The movement was so deft and quick that the footman hadn't even noticed it. Drawing Garrett to a corner, where a tall feather palm occupied a terracotta pot, Ethan handed the glass dish to her. It contained a frosty mound of lemon ice, with a tiny mother-of-pearl demi-tasse spoon tucked at the side. Garrett received it gratefully and took a bite of the tart, icy fluff. It melted on her tongue instantly, luscious, thin coldness sliding down her throat. A sense of unreality drifted over her as she stared up into Ethan Ransom's face. The severe perfection of his appearance was slightly unnerving. After taking another bite of lemon ice, she asked hesitantly, "How have you been since we last met?"
"Well enough," Ethan said, although his expression conveyed he hadn't been well at all.
"I tried to imagine what you were doing, but I have no idea what your typical day is like."
He seemed vaguely amused by that. "I don't have typical days."
Garrett tilted her head as she looked up at him. "Would you mind if you did? That is, would you dislike keeping to a regular schedule?"
"It would help if the job were interesting."
"What would you do if you could choose anything?"
"Something in law enforcement, probably."
His gaze swept the room, his expression inscrutable.
"I have a hobby I wouldn't mind spending more time on."
"Oh?"
"I design locks," he said.
Garrett regarded him uncertainly.
"Are you speaking as Mr. Randolph?"
His lips twitched as he looked down at her.
"No. I've meddled with locks since I was a boy."
"No wonder you were so critical of my front door," Garrett said, fighting the temptation to reach up and touch the dimple in his cheek. "Thank you for the improvements you made, the lock and hinges, and the lion's head knocker. I like it very much."
Ethan's voice was soft.
"Did you like the violets?"
She hesitated before shaking her head.
"No," he asked.
More softly still.
"Why not?"
"They reminded me that I might never see you again."
"After tonight you probably won't."
"You say that every time we meet. However, you keep popping up like a jack-in-the-box, which has made me increasingly sceptical."
Garrett paused before adding in an abashed tone. "And hopeful." His gaze caressed her face.
"Garrett Gibson. As long as I'm on this earth, I'll want to be wherever you are."
She couldn't help smiling ruefully.
"You're the only one who does.
I've been in a foul mood for the past 2 weeks. I've offended nearly everyone I know and frightened off one or two of my patients."
His voice was dark velvet.
"You needed me there to sweeten your temper."
Garrett couldn't bring herself to look at him as she admitted huskily,
"Yes."
They were both silent then, suffused in the awareness of each other's presence, nerve endings collecting invisible signals as if their bodies were communicating by semaphore. Garrett made herself take the last bite of lemon ice, little more than a spoonful of slush, but her throat was so tight with pleasure she could hardly swallow. Gently, Ethan took the bowl from her and gave it to a passing servant. He escorted Garrett back to the drawing room, where they joined a circle of a half-dozen ladies and gentlemen. Ethan turned out to be accomplished at drawing-room etiquette, at ease with the courtesies expected of a gentleman introducing himself. It hardly escaped Garrett's notice that he drew every female gaze in the vicinity.
Ladies fluttered and preened in his presence, one even brazenly fanning her bosom in the attempt to draw his notice. Although Garrett tried to muster some sophisticated amusement, the feeling was soon crushed flat by annoyance. The small talk was interrupted as the Home Secretary, Lord Tatham, appeared at one of the drawing-room doorways. He announced that the ladies and gentlemen were now invited into the double salon for some musical entertainment. The mass of humid, suffocated bodies began to move as a herd. Ethan held back with Garrett, letting people push past them. "There'll be nothing left but the worst seats in the back rows," Garrett warned, "if there are any left at all."
"Exactly."
She realized Ethan intended to steal whatever it was he'd come for while the guests were being entertained. A familiar, gravelly voice intruded on her thoughts.
"I seem to have been replaced as your escort, Dr. Gibson."
It was Dr. Havelock, who appeared to be in a jovial mood.
"However, since you're in the company of Mr. Ravenel, I will relinquish my role with good grace."
Garrett blinked in surprise, having never known the keen-minded Havelock to make such a mistake before. She glanced quickly at Ethan's expressionless face, and back to the older man. "Dr. Havelock, this is Mr. Randolph of Durham." Perplexed, Dr. Havelock looked more closely at Ethan.
"I beg your pardon, sir. I could have sworn you were a Ravenel."
He turned to Garrett.
"He favours the Earl's younger brother, does he not?"
"I couldn't say," Garrett replied, "since I haven't yet been introduced to Mr. Ravenel, although Lady Helen has promised it will happen some day."
"Mr. Ravenel came to the clinic," Dr. Havelock remarked, "to visit Lady Pandora after her surgery. Were you not introduced to him then?"
"Regretfully, no." Dr. Havelock shrugged and smiled at Ethan.
"Randolph, is it a pleasure?"
They exchanged a firm handshake.
"In case you weren't aware, my good fellow, you are in the company of one of the most skilled and accomplished women in England. In fact, I would say Dr. Gibson has a male brain in a woman's body."
Garrett grinned wryly at his last comment, which he knew had been intended as a compliment. "Thank you, Doctor."
"Despite my short acquaintance with Dr. Gibson," Ethan said, "her brain seemed entirely female to me."
The remark caused Garrett to stiffen slightly, as she expected a mocking comment to follow. Something about how a woman's mind was changeable or shallow, the usual clichés. But as Ethan continued, there was no hint of teasing in his tone. "Keen, subtle, and quick, with an intellect strengthened by compassion. Yes, she has a woman's mind." Thrown off guard, Garrett stared at him with a touch of wonder. In that brief, private moment, Ethan looked as if he really did prefer her to everything else in the world. As if he saw all of her, the good and the bad, and wouldn't change a thing about her. As if from a distance, she heard Havelock's voice.
"Your new friend has a silver tongue, Dr. Gibson."
"Indeed he does," Garrett said, managing to tear her gaze from Ethan's. "Would you mind if I continue to keep company with Mr. Randolph?"
"Not at all," Havelock assured her. "That spares me from having to listen to the musicale, when I would much rather indulge in a cigar with friends in the smoking room."
"A cigar?" Garrett repeated, pretending to be shocked. "After all the times I've heard you refer to tobacco as a poisonous luxury. Not long ago you told me you hadn't smoked a single cigar since your wedding."
"Few men can defeat a willpower as strong as mine," Havelock said. "But by Jove, I've done it!"
After Dr. Havelock had left them, Garrett studied Ethan closely. He was right about something. "You do have the look of the Ravenels, especially your eyes. I can't think how I missed that before. What an odd coincidence." Ethan didn't reply to that, only frowned as he asked,
"Why does Lady Helen want to introduce you to Weston Ravenel?"
"She seems to think we would enjoy each other's company, but I haven't had the time to meet him yet."
"Good. Don't go near the bastard."
"Why, what's he done?"
"He's a Ravenel. That's reason enough."
Garrett's brows lifted. "You bear ill will toward the family."
"Aye."
"Even Lady Helen? She's the gentlest, sweetest-natured woman in the world. No reasonable person could dislike her."
"There's none of them in particular I hate," Ethan said in a low tone.
but all of them in general. And if he ever take up with Ravenel, I'll have to throttle him with my bare hands. For a moment, Garrett was too taken aback to respond. She stared at him with cool disapproval. I see. Beneath that smartly tailored evening suit, there's nothing but a jealous brute, with no ability to control his primitive urges. Is that it? Ethan regarded her without expression, but after a moment she saw a glint of humour in his eyes. Bending his head over hers, he murmured, "That's probably best for both of us, Akushla. If you never find out what's beneath my evening suit." Garrett had never been the kind of woman who blushed easily, if at all, but she found herself turning as red as a beetroot. Looking away from him, she tried to bring the rampant colour under control. "How can you hate an entire family?" she asked. "They can't all have done something to you."
"'Tis not important."
Obviously that wasn't true, but Helen hadn't mentioned a word about any conflict between the Ravenels and Ethan Ransom. What in the world could have made him so hostile? She decided to take the matter up with him in the future. They lingered in the refreshments room until most of the crowd had departed for the double salon, and they drifted out with the last few stragglers. Lady Chatham's voice could be heard in the distance, announcing the first of the entertainers. The serene piano notes of Chopin's Polonaise in E-flat major rippled into the hallway like the cool, soothing water of a brook. Instead of heading toward the music, however, Ethan took Garrett along a hallway to the other end of the house and down a set of private stairs. "Where are we going?" Garrett asked.
"Tarum's private study."
They proceeded to the ground floor level, crossed the entrance hall, and went along a quiet hallway. They reached a door near the end, and Ethan tried the handle. It refused to budge. Lowering to his haunches, Ethan examined the lock.
"Can you open it?" Garrett asked in a whisper.
"A pin and tumbler lock?"
he asked, as if the answer should have been obvious. He fished a pair of slender metal tools from an inside coat pocket. Meticulously, he inserted an instrument with a crook at the end into the bottom of the keyhole, and used the other pick to work the pins inside, lifting them one by one. Click, click, click. In no time at all, the barrel turned and the door opened. After guiding Garrett into the dark room, Ethan took a tiny steel match case from his pocket and deftly lit a batwing lamp that extended from the wall. A short, wide sheet of flame filled the glass bowl shade, spilling a white glow through the room. Garrett turned to view her surroundings and started at the sight of an Irish setter sitting calmly by the hearth before she realized that the canine had been stuffed by a taxidermist. The study was bursting with an abundance of decorative objects, peacock feathers sprouting from a cane-necked vase, bronzes, figurines, and ornamental boxes. Most of the walls were covered by towering black walnut cabinetry, with drawers and shelves, some of them with locks built into the front. What little wall space remained was filled with paintings of dogs and hunting scenes, as well as small artifacts and oddments displayed behind glass-fronted frames. Beyond the swags of velvet drawn back from the window panes, embellished iron bars and scrollwork formed a protective cage around each casing. Ethan had gone behind the desk and was running his fingers lightly over a section of wall panelling set at dado height.
"What are you looking for?" Garrett asked in a hushed voice.
"Account ledgers."
He pressed a length of framed moulding and released a hidden catch. The panelling swung open, revealing the front of a rather astonishing object, a massive steel sphere affixed to an iron pedestal. Garrett came up behind him.
"What is that?"
"A cannonball safe."
"Why isn't it shaped like a rectangle?"
"More secure this way. You can't blow the door off. There's no place to insert explosives. No bolts, rivets, or screws to pull out. And no joints to force wedges into."
Lowering to his haunches, Ethan examined a curious brass dial with numbers and notches at the edge. It had been attached to the centre of the faceplate.
"A keyless lock,"
he murmured, before Garrett could ask. He reached into his coat and pulled out a brass disc. A brief shake, and the instrument extended into a narrow cone. It was a collapsible telescopic ear horn, the kind many of Garrett's elderly patients used.
She was mystified as he hooked the wire earpiece over his ear and bent to listen intently as he rotated the brass dial.
"I need to find the sequence that will open the lock," Ethan said. "The clicks of an inner drive wheel will tell me how many numbers make up the combination."
Returning his attention to the task, he rotated the dial and kept the ear horn pressed to the door.
"Three numbers," he said eventually. "Now for the hard part, figuring out what they are."
"Is there some way I could help?"
"No, it's..."
he began, and stopped as a thought occurred to him.
"Do you know how to plot markers on a line chart?"
"I should hope so," Garrett said, lowering to a crouch beside him. "I could hardly maintain my patient's records properly otherwise. Would you prefer the markers connected or left scatterplot?"
"Connected,"
Ethan said. He shook his head slightly as he glanced at her, the hint of a dimple appearing. Reaching into his pockets, he pulled out a small notebook, the pages printed with a faintly inked grid. He handed the book to her.
"Starting position numbers are on the horizontal axis. Contact point numbers are on the vertical axis. As I test numbers on the dial, I'll tell you which ones to map out."
"I had no idea safecrackers use coordinate paper," Garrett said, taking a tiny pencil from him.
"They don't, yet. At the moment, I'm probably the only man in England who can get past this lock. It's a mechanical device with its own set of rules. Even the craftsmen who make it can't do it."
"Who taught you, then?"
Ethan hesitated before replying.
"I'll explain later."
He bent to his task, setting the ear horn back against the safe. As he gently manipulated the dial, listening for clicks and murmured sets of numbers to Garrett, she plotted them out efficiently. In no more than 10 minutes, they were finished. She handed back the book and pencil. Ethan studied the pair of jagged lines on the chart and drew crosses at the points where they converged.
37, 2, 16.
"What order do they go in?"
"That's a matter of trial and error."
He dialed the numbers from largest to smallest with no result. Next, he tried from smallest to largest. As if by magic, a smooth mechanical sound reverberated from the innards of the safe.
"How very satisfying!" Garrett exclaimed triumphantly.
Although Ethan was trying to maintain his concentration, it seemed he couldn't hold back a grin.
"You have the makings of a fine criminal mind, Doctor."
He rose to his feet and wrenched the top handle of the safe downward. A circular door, at least 7 inches thick, soundlessly pivoted open to reveal the interior. Somewhat anticlimactically, the contents consisted of a simple stack of files and ledgers. But Ethan's breath had quickened, and a notch of concentration had appeared between his thick brows. Garrett could tell that his thoughts were in a ferment of activity as he pulled out the stack and set it on the desk. Searching through the materials, he found a volume he wanted and spread it flat. He began to thumb rapidly through the pages, his gaze taking in dozens of entries at a time.
"I expect we'll be discovered soon," he said without looking up. "Go to the door and watch through the crack. Tell me when someone approaches."
His voice was dispassionate, his actions swift but measured, as he sorted through the stack. Garrett's insides tightened with unease. She went to the closed door and discovered there was just enough of a space between the edge and the jamb for her to squint through. With a touch of amazement, she realized that Ethan was so attuned to detail, so aware of everything in his periphery, that he noticed such things as a quarter-inch-wide crack in a door. 2 or 3 minutes passed while Ethan rifled through the account book. He pulled a folding knife from his coat and flicked it open. The blade flashed as he severed a few pages neatly from the bound spine.
"Are you nearly finished?"
Garrett asked in a hushed voice. He responded with the briefest of nods, his expression impassive. She wondered at his excessive calmness when anxiety percolated all through her. As she returned her attention to the hallway, she saw a flicker of movement, and her stomach flip-flopped.
"Someone's coming,"
she whispered. Hearing no response, she looked back over her shoulder and saw Ethan gathering the files and ledgers back into a stack.
"Someone, I heard."
Garrett looked through the crack again. The distant figure had enlarged rapidly. The man had reached the door. She started and took several steps backward as the knob rattled. Casting a wild glance at Ethan, Garrett saw that he had set the stack of materials back into the safe and was fiddling with the lock. A key was inserted into the door. Garrett's heart performed acrobatic feats, seeming to launch skyward as if it had been shot from a cannon, descending with gathering velocity, then catapulting again. What in God's name should she do? How should she react? In the midst of her panic, she heard Ethan's quiet voice.
Don't move.
She obeyed, frozen and struggling in every muscle. With a swiftness that defied the laws of physics, Ethan closed the safe and pushed the panelling back over it. He tucked a handful of folded pages neatly inside his coat. Just as the key twisted in the lock, he vaulted sideways over the desk with stunning ease, the fingertips of one hand touching the surface lightly as he passed over it. Garrett turned toward him blindly as he landed with cat-like grace. In the next moment, she felt his arms close around her. A panicked sound escaped her, and he smothered it with his mouth. Her head was pushed back from the hard, hungry pressure of his kiss, but he gripped the back of her neck with a supportive hand. The tip of his tongue flicked between her lips like the touch of flame, and she couldn't help opening for him. He gathered her more firmly into his embrace, the kiss intensifying until her bones turned molten, and she felt faint. All she wanted was to relax into darkness and sensation. Ethan's hand stroked her face as he eased his mouth slowly from hers and guided her head to his shoulder. The sheltering tenderness of his touch contrasted sharply with the soft menace of his tone as he spoke to the man who had entered the study.
What do you want, Gamble?
Chapter 13.
This room is off limits, came an accusing, rough-sawn voice. What are you doing in here?
Isn't it obvious? Ethan asked dryly.
I'm going to report this to Jenkins.
Tucked securely against Ethan's chest, Garrett risked a quick glance at the intruder, who was dressed in the evening livery of a butler or under-butler, but certainly didn't behave like one. He had the same air of alert physicality as Ethan, although his build was more wiry and spare. His hair was black and cut tight to the skull, emphasizing the aggressive angle of his brow. The skin of his face was youthful, unlined, a few pock marks pitting the cheeks and chin. An unusually thick neck pressed the front notch of his standing collar slightly open. As Garrett found herself staring into eyes as hard and flat as a pair of stove plates, she thought he looked like the kind of man she would have crossed the street to avoid. Feeling her stiffen, Ethan toyed with the soft hairs at her nape. His touch soothed her, communicating a wordless message of reassurance.
"Of all the rooms you could have chosen," Gamble asked. "Why, Tatum's office!" "I thought I'd help him out by doing some filing," Ethan said sarcastically. "You're supposed to be helping with security. So are you."
The air was charged with conflict. Garrett stirred uneasily within the covert of Ethan's hard arms. Earlier he'd warned her that she was holding a wolf by the ears. Well, at the moment she felt as if she were in the company of a pair of wolves, both bristling with aggression. Gamble looked at Garrett as if he were lining up rifle sights.
"I've been watching you."
At first she thought he was referring to the soiree, but then he continued,
"Going wherever you please, any time of day or night, doing a man's work when you should be at home with a mending basket. You do more good for the world that way than trying to become a man."
"I have no desire to become a man," Garrett said coolly. "That would be backsliding." Feeling the iron tension in Ethan's arm at her waist, she clamped her fingers on the hard muscle, silently willing him not to react to the other man's baiting. Her assessing gaze returned to Gamble's notched standing collar, where one side was pushed outward a few millimetres more than the other. A hint of swelling was just visible at the top edge. "How long have you had that lump on your throat?" she asked. Gamble's eyes widened in surprise. When it became evident that he wasn't going to answer, Garrett said, "The location on your thyroid gland would indicate the presence of a goiter. If so, it can be remedied quite easily with iodine drops." Gamble regarded her with raw animosity.
"Bugger off!"
Ethan gave a faint growl and started for him, but Garrett spun around and set both her palms on his chest.
"No, Mr. Ransom," she murmured, "not the best idea."
Especially not when his coat pocket was filled with information stolen from the Home Secretary's private safe. Gradually, the wall of muscle